Purim and Talmud, and the next Monday night we have the real thing, you know. So we don't need a shiur at that point. We just, you know, you come and the shiur is the Kriyas HaMegillah, I guess. What I want to focus on tonight is looking a little bit closer to the Megillah itself. Last time we sort of spoke about the Megillah outside, you know, in kind of general terms. Tonight I want to look at the chronology of the Megillah and put that against the background of the history that's going on at the time where the Megillah story is unfolding. And by putting those two things together, Be'ezus Hashem, I think we'll get a different perspective into the Megillah than we might have had previously. The first issue, just in terms of chronology, or the Seder, the order of the events that happen in the Megillah, is the startling realization that you come to when you analyze the dates. Most of the story of Purim takes place on Pesach. Well, just to figure that out, right? Just to figure that out. If you take a look at the sheet, that's just the Chumash and the Megillah and Rashi. It says 184 on the top. The pasuk which says it is not printed on this sheet, but if you take a look in the Megillah itself, when Haman casts the lot, right, back in Perek Gimel in the beginning of the Megillah, when Haman casts the lot, he comes out with Chodesh Adar, as we know, as being the month where the Jews are destined to be destroyed, and he declares it's going to be the 13th of the month of Adar. And then the pasuk goes on to say, on the 13th day of the month of Nisan, the decree was sent out to the 127 provinces in the Persian Empire. And that's a pasuk which is, again, I just didn't copy it because it's, it was too much room already to, didn't want to give out three sheets, but it's a pasuk in the Megillah. The Megillah says, Bishlosha Asar Yom Bo, right, on the month of Nisan, on the 13th day of Nisan. So that's when the letters were sent out to all the 127 provinces across Persia to destroy the Jewish people. And that's when Mordechai and Esther, among everyone else in the Persian Empire, becomes aware of the fact that Haman has just put into effect a decree to kill the Jewish people, to annihilate the Jews. Now again, the 13th of Nisan is 2 days before Pesach. Right. Now, as we're not thinking in those terms when we read the Megillah, because you're not thinking Pesach. Pesach, okay, that's after they give you all the Hamantashen. That's when you're supposed to clear out the Hamantashen, you know, in order to... That's the next holiday, but... But 13th of Nisan is 13th of Nisan. The Jews at that time presumably were observing Pesach, right? So there, everyone's getting ready for Pesach. You can imagine this. You know, it puts a different spin on things, right? The Jews are all running around probably crazy, just getting ready for Pesach. And all of a sudden the news hits that Haman has issued this decree against the Jewish people. Right? You thought all the other Pesach preparations were difficult. Okay, now here's something else to have to worry about. So we know, again, going over the story, Mordechai and Esther have a long conversation back and forth, where Mordechai tries to convince Esther to intercede on behalf of the Jewish people. And finally, if you look in the again on this first page, it's Perek Dalid, Pasuk Tesvav. I have circled here Pasuk Yud Zayin, right on the right hand column. You go back two psukim before that. Vatomer Esther Lahoshev al Mordechai, right? At the end of the whole conversation between Esther and Mordechai, Esther says to Mordechai as follows, right? She sends, right, Lech Knosis Kol HaYehudim, go gather all of the Jews, Hanimsa'im B'Shushan, who are to be found in Shushan, V'tsumu Alai, V'al Tochtu, V'al Tishlu, Shloshes Yom, Laila V'Yom, tell them to fast for me, not to eat or drink for 3 days, Gam Ani V'Naro Sai Od Tsum Kain, and I and my maidservants will fast as well, and after fasting for 3 days, I'll go and present myself to the king, even though he didn't call me. And roughly translated, whatever happens, happens. If this is meant to be the end, this is meant to be the end. Continues the pasuk, Vayavor Mordechai. Mordechai passed over. Now that's a very strange turn of phrase, right? Mordechai passed over. What did he pass over exactly? Right, and he performed everything that Esther told him to do. So if you take a look in Rashi at the bottom of the page, right, you have two arrows at the bottom of this page. The first one is pointing to Yud Zayin, Vayavur Mordechai. Says Rashi, Aldos. Now Rashi translates the word Vayavur, not that he passed over, but he transgressed. He committed an Aveira. What was the Aveira? Lehisanos Biyom Tov Rishon Shel Pesach. Because the 3 days come out to include the first day of Pesach. So the 3 days of fasting actually included the first day of Pesach. How so? Shehisana Yudalid bin Nisan, v'tesva v'teszayin. Right, the decree went out on the 13th of Nisan. Then Mordechai and Esther had this whole conversation. So they decided, let's fast for 3 days. So 3 days is Erev Pesach, the first day of Pesach, and the second day of Pesach. Right, so that's normally a violation. Now, first of all, they fasted on the first day of Pesach, the first 2 days of Pesach. Normally, you're not allowed to fast on Pesach altogether, number one. Number two, the chet, the averus, so to speak, was compounded by the fact that they left out a very major component of the holiday of Pesach, the Seder. Right? If they were fasting for 3 days, day and night, and that extended over the holiday of Pesach, so a very major part of Pesach involves eating different things, right? There's the matzah, the maror, the dalet kosos. So all that year of Purim, all of those mitzvos fell by the wayside.
But it was because nefesh,
yeah. Right, no, again, we're not, the Megillah isn't criticizing Mordechai for doing this, right? It was a necessity of the time, right? In other words, they had to daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save the Jewish people, and that meant even pushing aside Pesach if need be, but just, the Megillah says we should understand that what was involved in those 3 days was what ordinarily would be considered to be an Avera, right? The Jews committed a quote-unquote Avera by fasting over the day of Pesach. Now let's just take the story let's just work out the rest of the story. The rest of the bulk of the rest of the story of Purim happens in the span of a couple of days. Right? On the third day, Esther goes in to see Ahasuerus, and she says, why don't you come tonight to a party? That night they have the party. So Esther says to Ahasuerus at the party, why don't you come back, we'll have a second party. Over the course of that night in the middle, is the whole episode with Haman and Mordechai being led through the streets of Shushan, right? Then the following day is the party already, right? And it's at that second party that Haman is unmasked, right? And his downfall takes place and he's hung right away. So if you follow through the chronology, all of this is playing itself out over the first couple of days of Pesach. So it's fascinating. That's the bulk of the Megillah. Basically all the way from Perek Gimel, where Haman casts the original lots, he casts the original lots a few days before Pesach, till Haman is hanged at the end of Perek Ches, at the end of Perek Zion, rather, right, which is the bulk of the Megillah. So all of those stories, which we know to be the main crux of the Purim story, are actually playing themselves out over Pesach. And point of fact, if you take a look in the Pesach Haggadah, right, that's the next installment, you know, after we get through Purim, there are these two piyutim, these two poems which are recited at the end of the Pesach Haggadah, which probably are the least popular things to say in the entire Haggadah. Ve'amartem zevach Pesach, uvechein vayhi v'chatzi alayla. Right, I mean those, Chagadia, you know, beats those out. Chagadah has a tune. If uvechein amartem zevach Pesach had a tune, people would know those also. But didn't have the mazel to have a tune. Okay, so it doesn't have a tune, it doesn't have a niggun, so people don't know that. Right, it's things that happen at midnight because Makas Bukharis happened at midnight. The other one, V'amartem Zevach Pesach, commemorates events that happened in history on the day of Pesach. And one of the things that's mentioned, if you take a look in the Haggadah, was Haman was hanged on Pesach. Right, and that's commemorated in the Pesach Haggadah itself. So that's very striking. That gives you, I mean, again, it doesn't give you any additional insight into the story itself, but it does shift the focus in terms of the calendar as to what part of the year we're focusing on Purim. We think Purim Adar, most of the Megillah, chronologically, is playing itself out in the middle of Nisan, right around and during the holiday of Pesach. One wonders if there's any significance to that, to the fact that the Purim story itself is mostly taking place over Pesach. Just to underscore the connection between Purim and Pesach a little bit more, if we move away from the Megillah, just look in the realm of Halacha, we'll also see that the Halacha also seems to underscore some kind of connection between Purim and Pesach. Everybody knows, Mishenichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha. Right? So when the time Adar comes in, you're supposed to start being happy, whatever that means exactly, right? You're supposed to start being happy during Adar. Why are you supposed to be happy during Adar? So Purim, right? Purim's a happy time. Purim falls out in Adar. So we're supposed to be happy during Purim, so we're supposed to be happy in Adar, right? It all follows through. You have to ask yourself, Purim is a very nice and joyous time. Is that the happiest day on the Jewish calendar? It's nice, you know, it's a wonderful holiday, there's a lot of simcha. We pointed out last time that one of the reasons we don't say Hallel on Purim is because, in a certain sense, the miracle wasn't so complete. Akati Avdi Achashverosh Anon, we're still at the end of the story, the servants of Achashverosh. So certainly Purim would seem to pale in comparison with some of the other Yom Tovim, so why Mishinechus Adar Marbin B'Simcha? The truth is, if one takes a look, Rashi writes explaining that particular phrase, Mishinechus Adar Marbin B'Simcha, says Rashi, why? Says Rashi, because once Adar comes in, you have these two holidays of Geula. You have the holiday of Purim in Adar, and you have Pesach coming up in Nisan. So once Adar comes in, it's already a time of Geula, a time of redemption, which leads to a time of tremendous Simcha. So based on that Rashi, by the way, we have to just reformulate what Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha means. It doesn't mean the month of Adar alone is a time of Simcha, but really the entire month of Adar up through Pesach is a time of Simcha, it's a time of Geula, right? It's a time during which the Jewish people were redeemed. During Purim from the threat of Haman, and during Pesach from Mitzrayim, right, from Egypt. And that's a whole series of events, which is a whole package deal of Simcha. Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, meaning once Adar comes in, so now we start preparing for the long haul of Simcha, which is going to last a good month and a half, 2 months, starting from the beginning of Adar all the way through Nisan. What's relevant to our purposes, I mean, first of all, it's an interesting approach to Mishnechnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha, right? In other words, when you're in Nisan, you're also fulfilling Mishnechnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha, that's what emerges. But it also underscores this connection, right? In other words, the Simcha of Adar, of Purim, flows straight into Pesach, right? That Simcha, which starts with Purim, really goes straight into the holiday of Pesach. Apparently here too, there's some connection between these two times of Geula. Right? So far we have two connections, right? Now, number one, most of the Megillah story itself takes place on Pesach, right? The Simcha, which is inherent in Adar, really is supposed to spill into Pesach. The fact that we have Simcha in Adar, let's say it even more, the fact that we have Simcha in Adar derives to a great extent from the fact that once Nisan comes, Pesach is going to come, and it's a continuation of that Simcha. And finally, there's an interesting, again, halacha, which again seems to underscore the connection between Purim and Pesach. It's not just that they happen to fall out a month apart from one another. There's a halacha that Shloshim Yom Kodem HaChag, 30 days prior to Pesach, when it's supposed to start learning the halachas of Pesach. Right? If you ever try to go through the halachas of Pesach, I mean, it's Rabbi Blumenkranz's book is very thick, right? So it takes you a good 30 days to get through everything. So, I'm sorry? Yeah, so it takes you a good 30 days to get through everything. So you're supposed to start 30 days before. So when's 30 days before Pesach? So Purim. So the poskim point out, it's not just a coincidental thing. Say the poskim, there's a mitzvah to start learning the laws of Pesach on the day of Purim. Right? Right? Now, on the day of Purim itself, you should learn a little thing about Pesach to get the ball rolling in preparation for, you know, starting to learn the halachas of Pesach. So again,
you usually don't think Pesach until the Purim is over.
Right. But here you see the halacha itself is trying to forge a connection. Even while you're sitting down to your Purim Sutta, you know, learn something about Pesach, you know, anything, you know, the first little halacha in Shulchan Aruch about Pesach, you know, learn something about Pesach. Now again, that could be coincidence, right? Happens to be that Purim is 30 days before Pesach. Oh, I'm sorry? Well, the poskim say from Purim itself, which actually, right, no, that's a good point. That's really 30. Well, right, no, but Adar is always chosen. Adar is always chosen. Adar is always 29 days. So as it comes out, 30 days before is always going to be Purim, right? So in any case, it could be coincidence. Okay, it happens to be 30 days prior to Pesach is Purim, but the insistence of the halacha on starting to to learn the halachas of Pesach and Purim itself again seems to point to some deeper connection here between the two Yom Tov and between Purim and Pesach. So here we have three things that all seem to point to some connection between Purim and Pesach. What we tried to do tonight is again just looking at themes inside Megillas Esther to try to see what kind of connection there possibly could be between Purim on the one hand and Pesach on the other hand. Okay. I had a third sheet to give out and the copier didn't behave. So I'm going to read to you from the sheet. it's not an awful lot. It should be able to follow even without the sheet in front of you. This is a quotation from Sefer Ezra, Perek Dalet. Just to give a little bit of the historical background over here. We know that the Purim story itself, again we said last time, happened somewhere between 300 and 400 years BCE, prior to the Common Era. And the world power at that time was the Persian Empire. Right? The Persians have basically swept through what used to be the Babylonian Empire, the Empire of the Bavliim. And whereas the Babylonians had conquered most of the world at that time, most of the Middle East, the Persians had come through afterwards, taken over all of that, including Eretz Yisrael, they had a huge empire, right? The Psukim talk about 127 different provinces. And they hold the Yad Kush, which literally means from Ethiopia to India. So that's a pretty substantial stretch of the world that was known at that time.
Is Koresh related to Esther?
Yes, we'll talk about that, the different kings and how they play together. So there are when we read the Megillah and we think about the story, we're mostly focused on the events that are happening in Shushan, which is the capital city of Persia. We're not really so cognizant of the things that are going around the world outside of Shushan. But the truth is, if we turn our attention to Eretz Yisrael at that time, we'll see that Eretz Yisrael is in the midst of its own political turmoil. The Sefer Ezra is one of the last Sfarim in Tanakh, and it basically describes how after the end of the Galus Bavel, after the end of the exile into Babylonia, so when Koresh was the first, I don't want to say first, it was one of the kings of the Persian Empire conquered the Babylonians, so he gave the Jews permission to go back to Eretz Yisrael and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. So
No, there was another one.
Yeah, okay, well, Daryovish. Right, we'll talk about it because it's going to be important. So Sefer Ezra and Perek Dalet tells us the following story. Right, I'll read it and I'll try to make it as explanatory as possible. Vayishmu Tsari Yehudo bin Yamin. The Jews have just come back to Eretz Yisrael, and the Tsari Yehudo bin Yamin, the enemies of Yehuda and bin Yamin, the two tribes that went back to Eretz Yisrael, heard, Ki v'nei ha-golo bonim heichol Hashem Elokei Yisrael, that the members, the Jews who had been in Golus, were building a Beis HaMikdash to Hashem. Vayigshuel Zerubbabel v'yoroshe ha'avas v'yomrohem nivnei mochem ki chochem nidrosh le'lokeichem. They went to Zerubbabel, the head of the Jews who had come back to Eretz Yisrael, and they said, why don't we join you in this work of building the Beis HaMikdash? Vayomrohem Zerubbabel lo lochem v'lonu livnos bayis le'lokeinu. We're not interested in joining up with you and building a Beis HaMikdash to Hashem. You know, you live in Eretz Yisrael, your worship is somewhat tainted by idolatry. You're not pure monotheist. You're not interested in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu by himself. So we're not, you know, thanks but no thanks. You know, we appreciate your offer of trying to build a Beis HaMikdash, but we'd rather go it by ourselves. Vayihi am ha'oretz mirapim yedei am Yehuda, u'mevahalim osam livnos. So the Tsari Yehuda bin Yamin, these people living in Eretz Yisrael who were antagonistic to the Jews building the Beis HaMikdash, were very turned off by the fact that the Jews refused to allow them to participate. So they started giving the Jews a hard time, and they were trying to do everything in their power to prevent them from building the Beis HaMikdash. B'sochrin maleim yoatzim lohafer atzosam. And they would hire advisors, to get involved politically, and to try to prevent the Jews from a political perspective from building the Beis HaMikdash. Kol yimei Koresh melech paras, yan malchus Daryovesh melech paras. From the beginning of the days of Koresh, the ruler over Persia, up till the days of Daryovesh, there was this constant lobby, so to speak, among the Tsari Yehuda bin Yamin, trying to prevent the Jewish people from building the Beis HaMikdash in Eretz Yisrael. And here comes the pasuk which is directly relevant for the Purim story. Uvamalchus Achashverosh betchilas malchusa, during the reign of Achashverosh, in the beginning of his reign, kosbu sitno al yoshve Yehudov Yerushalayim. The enemies of the Jewish people wrote a hateful letter to Achashverosh concerning the people living in Yerushalayim. Now, it's not 100% clear. The next pasuk switches to Aramaic. Ezra's a very interesting sefer because the beginning of Sefer Ezra is all in Hebrew, And here, at this point in Perek Dalet, the Sefer switches over for a good number of chapters to Aramaic, which was the spoken language at the time. So the next pasuk says as follows: Uvimei artach shasta kasav bishlam mitrudas tovel shar kavanosav al artach shasta melech paras uchusav hanishtavon kasav aramis masurgan aramis. In the days, and here's a very important word, in the days of the king Artaxasta, yes, these enemies of the Jewish people wrote the following letter in Aramaic to the king. And the Psukim and Ezra go on to describe, they wrote in Aramaic, these Jews, they're building this temple, they're going to rebel against you, they're not going to pay taxes, they're a thorn in your side, you should prevent them from building the Beis HaMikdash. And King Artaxasta indeed puts a stop to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the big question over here is, who's this King Artaxasta? Oh, so there's a Machlokes HaMefarshim, right? Rashi writes, Artaxasta is a name like Paro, right? It's a generic name for the kings of Paras, right? Just the same way that Paro, Pharaoh, is the generic name for the kings of Egypt. So Artaxasta is a title more so than it is a name, right? And as such, says Rashi, Artaxasta is Koresh. They wrote to after Koresh had given the original permission to go and build the Beis HaMikdash. Koresh was Cyrus, the great Persian leader. After Koresh had given them the permission to go to the Beis HaMikdash, to go to Eretz Yisrael and build the Beis HaMikdash, the political lobby, the anti-Jewish lobby in Paras, managed to sway his opinion, and he said, you're right, I want you to stop building the Beis HaMikdash. That's how Rashi learns it. The Ralbag, in his commentary on Ezra, says no. Artaxasta is just an Aramaic equivalent of Achashverosh. So certainly, if we accept that opinion, then Achashverosh, in the beginning of his reign, right, meaning before the Purim story itself actually begins, in the beginning of Achashverosh's reign, one of the first things he did was to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash in Eretz Yisrael. Because again, Persia at that time has dominion over Eretz Yisrael. If we accept Rashi's interpretation that Artaxasta is Koresh, right? So Achashverosh wasn't directly involved in stopping the building of the Beis HaMikdash, but nonetheless, it was certainly a hot issue, right? In other words, what's clear in the Psukim is that during the days of Achashverosh, there was a letter sent to Achashverosh by the anti-Jewish lobby to try to get him to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash, to complain against the Jews, right? So certainly, while the whole Purim story is going to unfold years later in Shushan, an issue which is certainly on the back burner is the building of the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. That's a red button issue, which is burning at that time, years prior to the actual Purim story itself. Okay, so let's keep that in mind and take a look back in the Megillas Esther. So this is again the same page we saw before, page 184 at the top. Take a look in Perek Hay, Pasuk Vav, right? So it's circled, right? So at this point in the story, Esther has just gone in to greet Achashverosh, and Achashverosh, again, as we know the story, stretched out his scepter, he allowed her access, and said, "What do you want?" And she basically said, "I'm interested in having a party with you." Okay, good. So Achashverosh and Esther sit down to a party, and here comes Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Hamelach LeEsther B'Mishtei Hayayin. So the king said to Esther during the feast of wine, Masha Elosech Vinoseng Loch, what's your request that I'll give it to you? Umabakoshosech, and what do you desire? Ad Chamsi Hamalchus Viseyos, ask up to half of the kingdom and I'll give it to you, says the king. Right? So on the surface, that's just a very exaggerated or very generous, offer by Achashverosh. Esther, you're still beloved to me. Ask me whatever you want. I'll give you half the kingdom if need be. But Chazal interpret this in a very specific fashion. Take a look down at Rashi. It's the second arrow down at the bottom of the page. Ad chatzi hamalchus. Right? Up till half of the kingdom. Dovashu be'emso v'chatzi hamalchus. Right? Something which is in the middle. It sounds like the way Rashi is interpreting it is it's placed center stage in the Malchus, in the kingdom, Right? You can ask anything up till that, right? And as you ask me for anything, just don't ask me for that thing which plays center stage in the kingdom. What is that? Hu Beis HaMikdash. Don't ask me to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. I'll do anything for you, Esther Amalka. Just whatever you do, don't ask me to build the Beis HaMikdash. Shehizchilu livnoso bimei Koresh. They had started building the Beis HaMikdash in Persia, in Eretz Yisrael, back in the days of Koresh. V'chazar bo, v'tzivul of Atal HaMalacha. And Koresh changed his mind, and he made a decree to stop building the Beis HaMikdash. Again, that's Rashi consistent with his opinion in Sefer Ezra. Rashi was of the opinion that Artaxasta, the king who's referred to in Sefer Ezra, is Koresh. So somehow the anti-Jewish lobby managed to convince Koresh to change his mind. He had originally given the permission to the Jewish people to build the Beis HaMikdash, and now he was doing a flip-flop. Okay, so that's Rashi consistent with the way he interprets the Psukim in Ezra. So Koresh already, who had preceded Achashverosh, had stopped the building of the Beis HaMikdash. The Achashverosh she'omad acharav gam hu bitel hamelacha. And Achashverosh, who followed, continued the tradition of his predecessor Koresh and wanted to make sure that the Jews would not be able to build the Beis HaMikdash in Eretz Yisrael.
But the question here is Achashverosh.
Right, okay, 100%.
Achashverosh did not know that Esther was Jewish.
Right, right.
So how could he refer to it altogether?
So what you see from here is the next... Right, I mean, what you see from... No, 100%. I mean, what you see from here, again, the way Chazal interpreting the Pesukim, this is not... The building of the Beis HaMikdash was not a Jewish issue. It was not a narrow parochial issue. This was a political issue that had ramifications far beyond just the issue of the Jewish people, to the point where Achashverosh, not even knowing that Esther was Jewish, suspected that she might ask him to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash for whatever motivation she had. But obviously they weren't Jewish ones, because again, at the time, Achashverosh doesn't realize that she's Jewish. And Achashverosh is prompted to preempt her and says, don't ask me that, right? No, ask me anything, ask me for anything in the world, just don't ask me about the Beis HaMikdash. Clearly the Beis HaMikdash is very much on the mind of Achashverosh.
Sticky issue.
Right. And we see that from the very beginning of the Megillah. Right? The very beginning of the Megillah, so the Megillah describes how Achashverosh makes this lavish party, right, and calls everybody to participate in this party. And Chazal tell us, I think we've referred to it perhaps here before, Chazal say, what was the motivation that Achashverosh had in making this party? Says the Gemara, Achashverosh calculated or miscalculated that the 70 years after which HaKadosh Baruch Hu had promised to bring the Jews back from Galus had elapsed. There was no Beis HaMikdash, the work on the Beis HaMikdash was stopped. And said Achashverosh, good, we've finally shown that the Jewish prophecy is not going to come true. And the way Chazal tell the story, so he takes the kalim, the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, and uses them as the kalim, the vessels, for serving this elaborate seuda, this elaborate party at the beginning of the Megillah, and he himself comes out wearing the Bigdei Kohen Gadol. He himself puts on the vestments of the Kohen Gadol and parades around at the Mishneh to show everyone the Beis HaMikdash is not in the process of being rebuilt, it's not going to be rebuilt, the Jews were wrong, the Nevi'im were wrong, and the whole party, the whole thrust of the party is to show the Beis HaMikdash is not going to be rebuilt. That's why the Minhag Yisrael is that when we lay in the very beginning of the Megillah, there's a line, V'chelim Mikelim Shonim, right? That the various vessels which were brought out by Achashverosh were of different, vessels of a different nature. There were various vessels which were brought out by Achashverosh at this party. And the Minhag Yisrael is to lay in that phrase when the Megillah Seicha Trump, right? With the mournful trump that's associated with the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because we're reading essentially between the lines about a party that showed Achashverosh's contempt for the whole institution of the Beis HaMikdash and the fact that he was rejoicing over the fact that Beis HaMikdash was not rebuilt. Right? So let's just try to put all of this then in perspective. Sometime before Achashverosh's reign and during Achashverosh's reign, there's a major lobby in Eretz Yisrael to keep the Beis HaMikdash from being rebuilt. They managed to convince either Koresh or Achashverosh to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Achashverosh throws a party at the beginning of the Megillah to celebrate the fact that the Beis HaMikdash is in ruins and will remain in ruins as far as he's concerned. And when Esther, who to his mind is a non-Jew, approaches him with a request, the first thing that comes out of Achashverosh's mouth is, you can have whatever you want, but I'm not interested in building the Beis HaMikdash. Right? So we already begin to get a different perspective on the story. This is not just a narrow story about one anti-Semitic incident and the attempts to get around it, how Mordechai and the rest of the Jews and Esther managed to get out of the anti-Semitic decree of Haman. In the background, during this whole story, there's the Beis HaMikdash looming in the background. The Beis HaMikdash is supposed to be rebuilt. It's in the process of being rebuilt. The work has been stopped on it. The Achashverosh and the entire Persian kingdom are essentially celebrating the non-building of the Beis HaMikdash, and he's not willing to give in anything on the building of the Beis HaMikdash. That's the backdrop for all of this discussion. Now, just let's carry it through to the end of the Megillah. Right? So now, Haman has been unmasked. The Jews have been given permission to take vengeance against all of the people who have sought to destroy them. And with that, we take a look at the second sheet, the one that says Megillah Esther Tess at the top. One of the basic questions which to be shown them already raised on the Megillah, and something that to many people is somewhat morally troubling, is the whole last two prakim of the Megillah basically celebrate the fact that Jews go out and they kill their enemies. When you're learning the story in elementary school, they don't tell you that part. You know, the end of the story is, you know, Haman is defeated, they hang Haman, they hang the 10 sons, and everybody lives, you know, happily ever after. The truth is, I mean, the last two, three prakim of Megillah Esther basically describe how instead of Yud Gimel Adar being a slaughtered a massive number of people who were the enemies of the Jewish nation. Both in Shushan and outside of Shushan, right? In Shushan, the fighting went an extra day,
yeah.
Right? And as it went the 13th and the 14th, but it was both in Shushan and outside of Shushan, there was a massive retaliation by the Jews against their enemies. Now, the impression you get from the simple reading of the Megillah was that it wasn't self-defense. Right? As the Megillah is describing how the rest of the people, you know, both in Shushan and outside of Shushan, are cowering in fear from the Jews. The pasuk says, "V'chol amei ha'aretz misyadim ki nafal pachad ha'yehudim aleihem." All of the people in the provinces of Persia were converting to Judaism because they were so. All of a sudden, it was good to be Jewish. That was the good side of things, right? So everybody was converting. They were running to be Jewish, and the impression you get again from the simple reading of the Megillah was the Jews didn't act in self-defense. They took the offensive. They went out and actively sought out people who were their enemies, however you want to define that. We'll talk about that in a minute. And they killed them, essentially.
They asked for permission.
Well, they got permission, right. Esther got permission.
She was the first, and then she asked for one more for Shushan.
No, but why did they do that? Why weren't they just content to say, okay, Haman's dead, the anti-Semitic decree is over, okay, let's
11 months elapsed.
Right.
And they were afraid that they were, you know, under the impression that they had these books in front of them that they can go out and kill the Jews.
Right, but
so maybe they're happy it was preemptive.
Okay, it could be. The question is, what was happening on
11 months?
What was happening on the political level? It sounds like Esther is, again, the end of Megillah isn't really very clear. It sounds like from the end of Megillah that Esther and Mordechai sent out something that rescinded the original decree. Okay, so they rescinded the original decree. Okay, so Shalom Yisrael. So, like, why do we have to have a war? You know, why was that such an essential part of things? Yeah, sorry. Right. So it's an 11-month gap, basically. Right. That's something else you don't realize reading the Megillah. It's basically from the time that Haman is killed till the actual war that Purim commemorates is roughly 11 months.
But they had the permission to go out because they still have.
Yeah, but why do they want the permission?
Why they want?
I guess it represents Amalek. They got to wipe them all out.
You know, could work on them, and they were afraid.
Oh, okay. So let's discuss two possibilities, right? It's not the only two possibilities, but two ways to answer the question, right? So one of the answers to the question, just it's not so germane to our general theme, but it's just worthwhile to know the answer. One of the answers to the question is given by the Ibn Ezra. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra is one of the classic commentaries on Chumash. He writes a commentary on the Megillah as well. Ibn Ezra asked the question, like, why was it so necessary for the Jews to fight against their enemies? You know, they should have just, you know, Haman was hanged. Okay, let's just be happy. You know, why do we have to go further than that? So the Ibn Ezra gives an interpretation to the story which is sort of similar to what, at least I learned the story growing up, but he really fleshes it out a little bit more. There's this thing going on in the Megillah that ki chesav asher nichtav b'shem ha-melech v'nachtom b'shem ha-melech ein lahashiv. Once the king sends out a decree, you can never rescind the decree. Right?
There is the enemy could still go on and fight them.
Right. That's why they had to send.
So in other words, the enemy was still, you know,
that's
on
right,
the
still right.
So they had
the
right.
influence.
Right.
That's why they had to send out the other.
Right. In other words,
in 11 months you could work on them.
Right.
So it's not hard for them to hate you.
Right. So that could be one reading of it. Meaning, once the king gave his permission for the enemies to attack the Jews, even though they were afraid, again, you get the impression after reading the Megillah that they were incredibly afraid of the Jews, right? But even though they were afraid, at least some people were not afraid, so the Jews were given permission to give a preemptive strike. Okay, again, you read the Megillah, it doesn't sound like it's self-defense or even a preemptive strike. It sounds like they were just given permission to go out and kill the enemy. So it says, oh, so we'll come to that in a second, that maybe with the second answer, right? But says the Ibn Ezra, again, that's the way, says the Ibn Ezra, this is the way decrees work in the Persian Empire. Once it's signed and sealed and delivered, you can't do anything against that, right? And says the Ibn Ezra, I'll bring you the greatest proof for this, right? Sefer Daniel, right? If the story in Sefer Daniel, so Daniel is the Jew who's living in the Persian Empire. The king, the emperor, Daryovish, is very sympathetic to Daniel. And enemies of Daniel concoct a plot that anyone who's found bowing down to, you know, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be thrown into the lion's pit. The king, Daryovish, signs it, seals it, you know, puts it into law, and then he's terribly upset when he finds out the object of this plot is Daniel himself, but says, Daryovish, I have no choice. Once I signed an edict into law, I can't change it myself, and I have to throw you into the lion's pit. And of course, we know the end of the story. Daniel is miraculously protected by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though he's in the midst of the lion's den, right? So says the Ibn Ezra, what you see from that story is that literally, the king himself cannot change the decree which goes into effect. Says the Ibn Ezra, Mordechai and Esther had the following idea. How could they deal with the fact that the Haman's decree had already gone into effect and the enemies of the Jewish people were given free license to fight against the Jews? So says the Ibn Ezra as follows, Mordechai and Esther sent a second letter that said as follows. Haman sent out this law indicating that the enemies of the Jews are allowed to attack the Jewish people. But Haman was not loyal to the king, and therefore he actually changed what the king's original command was. The king's original command was not to allow the enemies of the Jews to strike the Jews. It was to allow the Jews to strike their enemies. So this way, says the Ibn Ezra, since it wasn't a new decree, it was a reinterpretation of the old decree. That way they could slip it under the rug, so to speak. It would still be kosher according to Persian law. And yet that would that would enable the Jews to get away, because otherwise, says the Ibn Ezra, the Jews would be in a vulnerable position. There was no way to reverse that decree which had been made against the Jewish people. The only way to reverse it was to claim that it had been falsified from the very beginning.
It doesn't say in the beginning that they wanted to get permission to defend themselves.
Doesn't say defend. The word defend is never in the Megillah. Yeah.
What did they ask for?
Right.
To defend it.
Harog hayudim ve'adet. It's always the word, you know, laharog. They killed people. Right. So again, you could read that it was defensive, but you don't get that impression from the Megillah that they were they were engaging in self-defense, right? Because you can say they were engaging in something preemptive, right? But it sounds like the Jews were taking the offensive, right? And the question that the Mefarshim are struggling with. It's the beginning of Perek Tes.
That's not exactly defensive.
It's a little nonsensical, right? But as Ibn Ezra says, that was Persian law, and as once it's signed, right?
But I thought that this is what, after all these happenings,
beginning of Perek Tes.
Those that want to hurt them.
Okay, so you could read it that way, but
before they weren't allowed, if it was right. Haman's decree, right. they would get killed. But now they ask to be able to, you know, fight back.
Yeah, okay, no, but it doesn't sound like fighting back. Shloach yod b'mvakshei rosam, to stretch a hand forth against to strike those who sought to do evil to them. Now seeking. I'm sorry? Right, but seeking to do evil is not the same thing as.
But would they really kill the Jews now that Haman was dead?
Oh. Right. Well, that brings out the question, right? Because Haman's dead.
Haman is dead.
Right. So it does. Right. It does.
Haman had a lot of followers. He wasn't the only enemy. Oh. He had people around him, and that's what they were afraid of.
Okay.
And the decrees were in their hands.
Right. Okay. 100%. But again, you know, just to make the point, it's not self-defense. It's not like the followers of Haman came into the house with swords and, you know, they fought them back. They had a whole they didn't need permission to do that. What if somebody comes into the house, you know, with a sword? So you have to say, no, I'm sorry, we don't have permission to fight you back. You know, it sounds like a preemptive strike.
What did they ask from the king?
That's that pasuk. Let's see.
Because you can't take back the decree, and they have to. What did they ask from the king?
Asher nosan hamelech la Yehudim asher b'chol ir v'ir lehi kohel v'lamodan afsham. Okay. Lahashmid laharog ulaabe des kolchel amu medina hatsorim osam tafin noshim. Right, they should kill everyone who's opposed to them. You know, women and children. Ushlol and Lavos, they can take all of their property, right? It seems that it's more than just self-defense. It's not as if they came in and the Jews were just fighting them off. It is, again, you want to say it's preemptive? It sounds like, okay. But, they were much more aggressive than the impression that you get. So, again, just coming back, that's the pshat that Ibn Ezra gives. In other words, the need to create an offensive on the part of the Jews was the only way to change the decree, right? And they couldn't rescind the decree altogether. They had to basically say the decree was misinterpreted by Haman. The decree was for the Jews to gang up on their enemies as opposed to the other way around. An alternative way that some of the Mefarshim say in explaining this is, Long Abani said before, who are these enemies of the Jewish people, right? So one can argue, and we'll see in a moment someone who says that inside, there's Zera Amalek, right? Number one, they're the descendants of Amalek. Haman himself is a descendant of Amalek, and the total annihilation which the Megillah seems to depict is consistent with Mechias Amalek, right? Ridding the world of Amalek, Taf V'Noshim, right? It doesn't say in the Pesukim about Amalek, but we'll see in a moment at least one of the Mefarshim is going to draw that analogy.
Were they able to differentiate who was what?
Again, you know, back in those days, No, and was, there wasn't, we think of the melting pot mentality, right? But in those days, the different ethnic groups presumably had a very easily identifiable identity, right? So that's number one. Number two, something to put in the context of what we're talking about, there seems to be possibly even a worldwide movement, but certainly a movement that's present in Eretz Yisrael to actively prevent the Jews from building the Beis HaMikdash, right? Perhaps some of these people the Jews are actively taking steps against are A, Amalekim, B, people who are actively looking to undermine the Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael, and were active cohorts in Haman in trying to destroy the Jewish nation altogether. Right? So we're not just talking about people that they made anti-Semitic comments or anything like that, people who were taking an active role in trying to annihilate the Jewish people. Right? I
they
enjoy that analogy. Yeah.
Okay. They feel that we don't think they're good enough, or we don't think they're
good,
they're religion is Jewish enough.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't draw that analogy. I mean, but
the Shamanim or whatever,
right? The Shamanim are not Jewish.
They didn't actually come to attack you. They wanted to participate.
Right, but once they were rejected, then they went on an all-out offense, you know, against the Jewish people. Well, take a look at this second page, the one that says Shimon Beis, Megillas Esther Tess at the top. On the bottom of the page is a commentary from the Megillas Starim. Megillas Starim was Rav Yaakov of Lisa, who wrote a tremendous amount on all different parts of Torah. He's well known for a commentary on a lot of Shulchan Aruch, commentary on the different Chamesh Megillos, the commentary on the Chumash, on the Agadata. He lives in Lisa, I believe, is Poland. Roughly the beginning of the 1700s. Right? So this is Rav Yaakov of Lisa. So Rav Yaakov of Lisa calls our attention to an interesting phenomenon in the Psukim. Right? If you look at the Psukim on top, where the arrow is, Pasuk Yutes in Perek Tes, Al Kein HaYehudim HaProzim, HaYoshvim Be'ori HaProzos, therefore the Jews who live in open cities, non-walled cities, Osim Es Yom Arbosar L'Chodesh Adar Simcho Mishta V'Yom Tov, Mishloach Manos Ishtoriyehu. That's why all the Jews in the unwalled cities make the 14th of Adar into a day of happiness and festivities and Yom Tov and Shalach Manos. Now the Gemara Maseches Megillah says that this idea of Yom Tov is meant to be taken very literally. Right? Says the Gemara Maseches Megillah, the Jews originally wanted to establish Purim as a Yom Tov like Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. You wouldn't be able to do malacha on Purim. That was the original plan, right? It was Simcha Umishta V'Yom Tov, a day of happiness, a day of rejoicing, of drinking, and a day of Yom Tov, right? So again, we usually read the Megillah, we think of Yom Tov in kind of generic terms. Yeah, it was a happy day, sleep late, you know, go to a late minyan, whatever, you know, it was a happy day. But the Gemara Maseches Megillah takes Yom Tov very literally. The Jews originally wanted to declare Purim to be a Yom Tov, and says the Megillah, And says the Gemara Maseches Megillah, Mordechai and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah interceded, and they said, it's worthwhile to make a holiday such as Purim, but let's not make it into a Yom Tov. Let's not make an Isser Malacha. And again, we know in our own observance of Purim, Purim is a weekday in terms of, you know, doing Malacha on Purim. You can write, you can drive. Right, if you can cook. I mean, if you couldn't cook, drive, and do all these other things, so probably you couldn't celebrate Purim, you know, the way it is. Right? So, the Gemara doesn't really explain what that conversation was all about. Why did the Jews originally want to make it a Yom Tov? And why did Mordechai and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah decide, you know what, let's not make it a Yom Tov, let's make it a regular weekday? What was going on over there? What was the concept which was being discussed? So that's where Rav Yaakov Alisa fills us in, and he gives a very fascinating idea which really plays into this whole theme, trying to see the Beis HaMikdash looming in the background of the Purim story. If you look on the bottom of the page where the first arrow is, V'lachach osu gam ken yom tov, right, where the brackets start. That's why the Jews initially made a yom tov on Purim. Shalafi datam shiro mechias amolek, v'choshvu shuhu aschalta de geula, v'roi hoyo shiye hagula shniyo kegula rishona, v'ak shigara machet, v'lafi datam shihi aschala de geula yeshlasos yom tov kemo begeula rishona. Says the Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa, the Megillah Starim, when the Jews saw the victory which had occurred, again, the victory wasn't just a military victory, but they associated it with the mitzvah of Machias Amalek, right? With the mitzvah of the destruction of Amalek. Now, we have a tradition which is recorded in the Gemara that the final annihilation of Amalek will take place right before the building of the final Beis HaMikdash. Right, that when the Jews come back in the days of Mashiach, there'll be three mitzvahs which will be fulfilled: the creation of a king, the annihilation of Amalek, and the building of the Beis HaMikdash. The Jews at that time saw the destruction of Amalek. They saw that there were a number of people who were Amalekim who were killed during the fighting. And again, from this statement in the Megillah Storm, you get the impression the fighting was directed wholly and solely at Amalekim. It was not an all-out fight against whoever was against the Jewish people. They specifically pinpointed the nation of Amalek, which had always been antagonistic to the Jewish people, as represented by Haman himself. They pinpointed those people, and the Jews thought, now that we destroyed Amalek, the next step should be the final Geula. It's the aschaut of the Geula, the beginning of the Geula itself. What's the final step in the Geula? Now we should have permission to finally rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. If that's true, so Purim is a step towards the ultimate redemption, the bringing of Mashiach himself. So certainly the Jews at that time say, well, if Purim is one step towards the bringing of Mashiach himself, we should make Purim into a Yom Tov. It's our Pesach, right? It's our Geula, right? Just as Pesach represented the original Geula, the redemption from Egypt, which would culminate in coming to the Eretz Yisrael, ultimately building the Beis HaMikdash, so too Purim represents our own modern-day Pesach, our Geula, which will culminate in the building of our Beis HaMikdash. So that's what the Jews thought. What did Mordechai think in responding? So if you skip down to the bottom of the page where the second arrow is, Ubitlu milasos Yom Tov. Mordechai and the Anshei Knesset HaGedola decided not to make it into a Yom Tov, after all was said and done. Kevon she'em ze'aschala de Geula. Because in point of fact, Purim would not prove to be the beginning of the Geula. Yes, there had been a partial Mechias HaMalek, but certainly it wasn't complete. And the Beis HaMikdash, it would prove, would not be rebuilt so quickly as an immediate result of the events of Purim. And again, as we pointed out from last time, Akate Avde Achashverosh Anan, we're still, after the end of the Purim story, we're still slaves to Achashverosh. So in a certain sense, There's a certain bitterness to the end of the Purim story. The Purim story is the Geula which almost was, right? It was almost the Geula. There was a rescinding of the anti-Semitic decree. There was a partial destruction of Amalek, but the Beis HaMikdash, which was the focal point of the whole Megillah from the beginning, is still lying in ruins at the end of the Purim story. And Mordechai and the Anshei Knesset HaGedola have decided, you know what? It's not worthwhile to turn Purim into a full-fledged Yom Tov. We'll leave it as a weekday because it's not quite the Geula that we ultimately anticipated. So based on all of that, I think we can finally come back and understand what the connection between Purim and Pesach is, and why Purim really culminates in Pesach, why we start learning the halachas of Pesach on Purim, and why Mishenichnas Adam Arba B'Simcha really means that we're starting a period of time during the year which starts with Adar and ultimately culminates with Pesach in the month of Nisan. Because Purim is really the Pesach that never came to fruition. Purim is the partial Pesach. It was almost a Geula in a certain sense, but it's not quite. We're still lacking at the end of the story. The Beis HaMikdash is still in ruins. We're still servants to Achashverosh. It's not quite a Yom Tov. We need Pesach to fill in the gaps that Purim doesn't quite have. As much as Purim from the very beginning looked like it was going to be Pesach, it was playing itself out over the holiday of Pesach, it looked like there would be a Mechias HaMolek that would bring itself to a fulfillment of the real Geula, but Purim doesn't quite make it. So that's why we need all these halachas to reinforce the connection between Purim and Pesach. Purim's a time of Simcha, yeah, Mishenichnas Adar Margin B'Simcha, but that Simcha is only really complete once we get to Pesach. And yeah, as much as we're involved in the day of Purim itself, we're sitting down to have the Sudas Purim, learn one halacha about Pesach, because forging that connection between Purim and Pesach is so essential for finishing off the Purim story. The work of Purim is unfinished, really, at the end of the Megillah. And we need Pesach to remind us that just as HaKadosh Baruch Hu was goel us, he redeemed us, way back in Mitzrayim, we're looking forward, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to redeem us in the future, Be'ezus Hashem, just as He redeemed us once upon a time. So we should be zalcha that as much as we celebrate the holiday of Purim, things in the world are kind of up in the air at the moment, and we should be zalcha to really see a geula very, very soon. Okay? Freilich and Purim.
Thank you very much.